From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge.
And I'm Jeff Tiberi. Today we're talking about two of those things that your mom might have told you not to discuss at the dinner table, religion and politics.
Later in the hour, we'll speak with a reporter and a political scientist about the current political alliance between white evangelical Christians and Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump.
But our first guest is someone you've heard here on WUNC before. Sarah McCammon is a national political correspondent for NPR and the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. She spoke with Leonita Inge about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church.
Sarah, welcome to Due South.
Thanks so much for having me.
First off, please describe the title of your book and the term Ex-Evangelicals. You know, that's sort of new to me. And when I hear you explain how maybe this concept or this term is kind of like been like on an online movement kind of, is it underground, would you say? I don't know. But please describe what an ex-evangelical is.
Well, in short, it's somebody who had an evangelical identity and has moved away from it for one reason or another. You know, I first came across it when I was covering the 2016 campaign for NPR. I had been assigned to the Republican primary and wound up covering, you know, several primary candidates and ultimately Donald Trump. And, you know, one of the big questions was, what would the white evangelical base that had been so influential and powerful in the Republican Party do when it came to Trump and his popularity? You know, he seemed to represent so many things that were antithetical to what the evangelical movement stood for. So there were lots of stories by myself and lots of other journalists around that theme in 2016. And just before the election, I was doing a story about that Access Hollywood video, that infamous video that came out,
right,
you know, a few weeks before the election, in which Trump, you know, is heard bragging about touching women in their private parts. And the story was about how evangelical women were thinking about this as their, you know, their movement was so aligned with him. There were some prominent evangelical women like writer and speaker Beth Moore who were saying, you know, this is too much. And one of the people we talked to for that story used the word ex-evangelical. She said, you know, some of us think of ourselves as ex-evangelicals. We don't like what the evangelical word has become. And it just stood out to me because I had had my own history with the evangelical world, which I write about in this book, you know, growing right. up deeply enmeshed in evangelical culture and politics. And I'd had my own complicated journey out of it many years before that. And so I started kind of paying attention to some of these conversations that were happening in online spaces and in podcasts. And I don't know if I would say it's underground. I mean, it's a lot of it's quite out in the open. Facebook groups, hashtags on TikTok and Twitter. There are some, you know, prominent people, including Abraham Piper, who's the son of a prominent evangelical thinker, John Piper, who is on TikTok. He has 1.7 million followers on TikTok, and a lot of what he writes or talks about is deconstruction and being an ex-evangelical. You know, some of these influencers have really big followings, and they're talking about a lot of different themes, some of them around evangelical politics, but lots of other issues that have created cognitive dissonance and forced them to sort of rethink their evangelical beliefs.
You know, it just seemed very new to me because I guess you have to know what you're looking for if you're following, you know, that on Facebook and more in more public arenas, because it was a very new term to me not too long ago. I mean, I guess I'm not a political reporter and I haven't covered, you know, the Trump campaign where it probably would have been, you know, has become sort of front and center when you think of what's become his base. But it also, I guess, ex-evangelical, like you said, it describes you and how you grew up. Is that correct?
Right. It wasn't a word that I had ever used for myself before. You know, I had my own kind of very private and sometimes painful journey of making sense of my own history with that movement. And as I write in the book, a lot of it was prompted by my relationship with my grandfather, who came out as gay late in life and who we had a really complicated relationship with, in part because he was gay and my parents believed that that was sinful, and because he was not a Christian. He was one of the few non-evangelicals that I had close contact with growing up. And you know, so that was sort of a trigger point for me, but there were lots of other issues that I get into in the book that things that just didn't sit right. And that's a theme I saw over and over again in these online spaces and increasingly in lots of podcasts that have sprung up to talk about the ex-evangelical experience, or what a lot of people describe as deconstruction. It's another big buzzword online that sort of describes rethinking one's religious upbringing, making sense of the things you were told as a child and trying to figure out, you know, what you actually believe. And I found that there were a lot of people having these conversations, and I just became fascinated by them.
I think in the book, when speaking about your and writing about your grandfather, you didn't have a lot of contact with him early in your life. I mean, I don't know if was that like not allowed. And I guess I'd like to know a little bit more about how you grew up, because I definitely want to get into what made you become a journalist.
Yeah. So I, you know, evangelicalism is a huge umbrella term. I also say, you know, as much as I never described myself as ex-evangelical until I heard the word, I didn't really describe myself as evangelical, even when I was one.
You thought that was normal. That was how you grew up.
We just thought of ourselves as Christians, and we thought we had the correct understanding of Christianity. You know, we were skeptical of Catholics, which is ironic if you study church history and know that Catholicism existed way before evangelicalism or Protestantism did. But, you know, we weren't sure if Catholics were quote unquote true Christians. We were skeptical of some mainline Protestants. You know, we believed that you had to have this very personal commitment, this experience where you, you know, asked Jesus into your heart and became a Christian. And that was, you know, that was what I was taught. And I was taught that, you know, anyone who didn't have that kind of a faith was frankly condemned by God. And so that was, you know, one of the things I really had to try to figure out. But I guess, you know, if you were to classify my beliefs sort of sociologically, we were theologically and politically conservative Protestant Christians. We believed that the Bible was literally true and without error. I was also taught that the earth was 6,000 to 10,000 years old. You know, I was educated in Christian schools that taught creationism. So just to give you a sense of the world I grew up in, you know, not all evangelicals hold identical beliefs, but those would be pretty common beliefs in the evangelical movement.
You even write about how, what even your parents, we're going to fast forward a few thousand years, but even would protest at abortion clinics.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people I grew up around had very strong opposition to abortion, opposition to same-sex marriage, and really believed that those were symptoms of a country in decline. You know, the rhetoric we hear now around Christian nationalism isn't really new. I heard a lot of that really in my Christian school textbooks, this idea that America was a Christian nation that was founded by Christians. Which, you know, if you study history, there's some truth in that. Some of them were, but a lot of them were deists, and you know, that's not the whole picture. And it was, they very intentionally, of course, set the country up to be a place with freedom of religion. But we saw the country as, you know, I was taught to see the country as in decline, as moving away from God. And, you know, of course, that picture was, there was a lot that was left out of that picture, including some of the a really thorough discussion of racial injustice that was present from the beginning of the founding of the country. You know, we didn't really talk about how to square that reality with this idea that this was a Christian nation. But I think that was partly because the circles I was raised in were primarily white. And it just, while we, you know, we were taught about slavery, we were taught about racism and taught that those things were wrong, I don't think that those issues had the urgency for us that they might have if we'd had a different lived experience.
Well, for some people, I guess, who are raised in a strict religious environment, they might have rebelled right away. But you write that that wasn't you. You know, like, about what age did you start rebelling?
I don't think I rebelled ever. Honestly, I was a really good kid. I was a straight-A student. I went to Christian college like I was supposed to. I married a Southern Baptist pastor's kid. But I always struggled with some of the things I've described. You know, I wanted to accept my gay grandfather. I had a hard time with the belief that I needed to try to convert everyone who didn't believe the way I did to my belief system. And I write in the book about a couple of times where I sort of tried to do that when I encountered people of other faiths, and about a time when I realized I just couldn't do that. I wasn't comfortable with it. You know, but I don't know that I would call that rebelling. I think it was, for me and a lot of the people I speak to in the ex-evangelicals, a really sincere struggle and a desire to get things right and do the right thing, not to rebel, not to make someone angry, not to hurt anyone. And I think that's actually kind of a misconception about people who walk away from their faith. I mean, you know, there's a lot of this ex-evangelical and deconstruction movement has caught the attention of some evangelical leaders who, as I describe in the book, have kind of spoken out and said that people are leaving because they want to sin. But I think a lot of people are simply trying to rethink some of the things they've been taught, and many are remaining religious, just not in the way that they were raised to be. So my process was slow and gradual, and yes, you know, later in life, I got a divorce, I got remarried to someone outside the faith, but I don't think that was an act of rebellion.
Not rebellion.
I think that was just, yeah, a product of where I was at that point.
Well, we're going to talk definitely more about that. We have a lot more questions for you, Sarah McCammon, national political correspondent for NPR and author of this new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Coming up on Due South. We're back with more Due South. I'm Leonida Inge. I'm here with Sarah McCammon, national political correspondent for NPR and co-host of the NPR Politics podcast, and author of the new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And what we've been chatting about, I guess, most recently is that you don't consider yourself, I guess, rebellious in the way that you just rebelled against the evangelical church, the Christian church, but that really, I guess you just kind of, did you grow up and just see the world in a different way?
Absolutely. And one of the things I try to convey, and that I know from experience and from my reporting for this book, is that this process can be really painful and really difficult, you know.
You use the word trauma, I noticed.
Yeah,
in the book.
There's a certain amount of, I think a lot of people use that word to describe, sometimes it's things that happened as part of their religious background. You know, one of the chapters is about religious trauma, which is sort of a field that I think more mental health therapists are becoming aware of and providing services for. And, you know, this is the idea that both experiences that would be traumatic in any case, things like sexual abuse in the church, which sadly are far too prevalent, that carries a special kind of trauma. You know, there's the event itself, the violation itself, and there's also the reality that it happened in a place that was supposed to provide spiritual care. And then there, for many people, there's a sense of being traumatized by aspects of their religious upbringing itself. You know, this real focus on hell and on, you know, on evil. And for someone like me who was told that, you know, that we could be raptured into the air at any time, that, you know, Jesus would come back and we would just be taken into the sky, you know, that was terrifying to me. And I thought I was the only one. But in talking to a lot of people that I interviewed for the book and have, you know, just encountered on some of these social media spaces, I think it's a common experience. It's a very scary idea. And I know that's what many evangelicals believe, but it's a, you know, it's a relatively new concept in Christian history. And some of these ideas themselves, especially when they're taught to a young child as absolutely true by every adult you know, without any sort of examination of the complexities of faith or the layers of nuance or the, you know, other alternative theologies. For a lot of people, there's a sense of trauma from that.
Well, you said you grew up sort of, until you got to a certain point, you feared that you wouldn't be saved.
For sure. I mean, there was a huge emphasis in my church, in my Christian school. Really, everything in my life was about the urgency of converting the world around us. You know, the word evangelical comes from the same root as the word evangelize. And, you know, the idea is that you're sharing the good news. But again, for a young child who's told your grandpa's going to go to hell if he doesn't accept Jesus, we have to pray for him every night at dinner, you know, and told that we have to try to convert people that we meet. You know, I talk in the book about a little girl I met at skating lessons when I was about 8 years old that I became friends with over the course of all of these weeks of practice and feeling like it was on me, you know, to save her, to tell her the truth and persuade her to believe as we did. And
so that's a trigger. You know, that's a trigger for me, the way you said that, because I remember I grew up in the Missionary Baptist Church in Florida. And I remember when my 13th birthday came around, my parents didn't do this, but other people in our church said, you know, if you don't join the church, you know, the sins are like no longer on your, you know, they just were trying to describe like, I don't know. I just remember feeling very dizzy and said, oh my goodness, I don't want the sins to be on my parents or, you know, let me join this church. And I did. I think there are pressures, every religion denomination has these pressures. But I guess one difference in those Christian pressures, if you're Christian, because my ex-husband, much of his family, they were Muslim from West Africa, from Senegal. And then you had those who were Catholic, you know. So still about accepting everybody, I guess, in this large bubble that we live in. And I wonder, I guess you struggled with that at first because your bubble seemed to be very small.
Right. I think I just wanted to accept people. Mm-hmm. And I was told that I shouldn't. And, you know, I understand religions have their teachings, and I'm not here to tell anybody that their religion is right or wrong or that they shouldn't be religious. But, you know, I can describe how it felt for me and how it felt for a lot of the people with a similar background. You know, at the same time, and I acknowledge this in the book, religious communities can be very helpful. And there's a lot of research that suggests that people have good mental health outcomes from being in those kinds of communities. But from my research and from talking to experts in this field of religious trauma, I think the understanding I got was that a lot of it has to do with how it's carried out. You know, what's the emphasis? What's the community like? And, you know, I think it's a challenge that a lot of people are going to have going forward in a society that is diverse and pluralistic and at the same time, decreasingly religious. How do you make sense of different ideas and different faiths around you? You know, I think this is not unique to evangelical kids, but because there was such an emphasis on these ideas, it was a big part of our upbringing.
So when and why did you decide to become a journalist? You know, did it have anything to do with when you were a Senate page? I mean, what made you want to be a reporter?
Well, I always liked words and writing, and I grew up in an environment where we did talk a lot about ideas. It was, as I've described, it was really important to get our ideas right, and it seemed like there was a lot at stake. And, you know, the people around me had very strong ideas about what was right and wrong. And so I was always sort of thinking about those things and wrestling with them. But I think as I got older, I really was sort of exhausted by this feeling that I had to have all the answers and I had to promote my vision of the answers to everyone else. I mean, that's quite a heavy weight to bear in many ways in a world where I think things are complicated and people's beliefs and ideas are shaped by their experiences in many ways. And so I found myself wanting in many ways to get away from that, I think, but also still fascinated by ideas. And, you know, in retrospect, I think what journalism offered me was a place where I could explore ideas and ask questions and consider other points of view. And that wasn't something that I was, you know, warned against as something that could be dangerous for my spiritual life, as I had mm-hmm. been in the church at times, but it was actually something that was encouraged. You know, the whole the whole point of, or a big principle of good journalism is trying to understand different perspectives, trying to understand what's at the center of a debate. Why are people disagreeing or fighting about something? And so for me, journalism was kind of exhilarating and freeing. And it was a place where I could focus on the questions rather than the answers.
So
and I liked that a lot.
So why not an arts reporter or a sports reporter or even a religion reporter? But I guess you chose politics. Or did it choose you? How did that happen?
Kind of both. I started out my career in the Chicago suburbs working at a daily suburban newspaper covering all kinds of things. I mean, I covered a park district in Naperville, Illinois, and wrote about whether or not they should expand and build a third golf course. So I wrote about all kinds of things. But, I got really kind of obsessed with public radio during that time. I was listening to NPR in the car as I was driving between interviews for my newspaper job and kind of decided I wanted to do that. I just really fell in love with the medium and hearing people's voices, hearing how they said things. And so I was able to kind of work my way into public radio through a small newsroom in Nebraska, where I started out in public radio. And there too, I was covering agriculture, I was covering water rights, but I always was interested in politics. I mean, again, it had been in the air growing up. And, I mean, long story short, I was recruited by NPR in 2016 to cover the 2016 campaign. And that was a dream. I had always wanted to the thought of covering a national presidential campaign was really exciting and seemed like a huge opportunity. I didn't choose the Republican primary, but it kind of made sense because I felt like when I was assigned to that, I kind of knew that world and kind of knew the vocabulary and the players a little bit more, having grown up sort of surrounded by conservative politics. And so, I was excited, but I'll admit, as the campaign went on, finding myself reporting on things that were so close to my own personal background was sometimes a little bit overwhelming. And I'll be honest, it still is sometimes. I did sort of fall into this niche. Mm. And in many ways, that's why I wrote this book, because I found my personal life, my personal history, running headlong into my professional work. And I felt like I had something to say about that.
Well, I'm speaking with Sarah McCammon, a national public radio reporter who covers the national political scene around this country. So I see your background in your life being very helpful in probably covering the 2016 presidential race. I wonder if NPR, I guess they didn't think that, I guess the people that you were covering in many cases in following the Trump campaign, that it wouldn't conflict at all with what you brought to the table?
Well, I wasn't hired because of my background. In fact, I didn't talk about it very much. I had some distance from that world, quite a bit of distance at that point. I was in my mid-30s, and I really hadn't been an active evangelical since my early 20s. And so, like anyone else, I don't think it came up. It wouldn't have been a factor. And I don't think it's unusual for people to cover. In fact, it's quite common for people to cover stories that have some intersection with their identity.
Because I know I couldn't. I mean, it was definitely frowned upon, as an African American woman, to cover race. They wanted some distance there early in my career. But as I got older, like you said, even in my 40s, I kind of demanded that I get to cover race.
It's evolved, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we live in a different world.
It's really, I mean, no offense to any of your editors, but I really disagree with that idea. I mean, as if anybody doesn't have a race or a racial experience, I mean, the idea that because you're from one race or another, you can't cover race, it seems like just intrinsically a bad idea. I think what's important is that we apply the principles of journalism to our work, right? That we're transparent, that we're honest, that we're seeking out multiple perspectives. And this is also why we have diverse newsrooms, right? So we can kind of check our reporting against each other. But I felt like having that history, I kind of knew what questions to ask. I understood the vocabulary. I understood the priorities. And it informed my reporting. I wouldn't want all reporters covering evangelicals to have a background in evangelicalism. Again, I think lots of perspectives are important, but I think having people in the room who sort of know that world inside and out is really valuable. And if you look at reporters like Tim Alberta, who recently released a book about evangelicalism and also has a similar background, I mean, I think you can see the value of bringing that perspective to bear.
Were you surprised at all the way the white evangelical church embraced Donald Trump?
Yes and no. I mean, I remembered, and I described this too, you know, I was a teenager at the time of the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, and it was a big deal in my community. Like, people were really angry about it. And there was a lot of messaging around the idea that character matters, and a president who's behaving like this is, you know, not carrying out his duty to the country. And that messaging was coming from people like Jerry Falwell Sr. and James Dobson, some of whom are still around, or their family members and organizations are still around. Jerry Falwell Sr. is not. But I remember how the evangelical community talked about that. And so then to fast forward to 2016 and that particularly the Access Hollywood video and see evangelicals accept Trump nonetheless, it was quite a stark juxtaposition, I think, in my mind as I reflected on that history. At the same time, though, I think if you understand the thinking that informed the movement, the sense that white Christianity was on the decline, that the culture had shifted away from some kind of Christian history that they had a vision of. And if you hear Trump's promise to, quote unquote, make America great again, I think that in many ways that tapped into this idea that had been present in the white evangelical movement for a long time, that, you know, this country used to be closer to God and it slipped away in some way. Well, that slipping away in their minds happened at the same time that white Christianity really began to decline as a share of the population. And, you know, there are very smart academics and researchers who I draw a lot of my reporting from, people like Robert P. Jones at the Public Religion Research Institute, who argue that decline in cultural power in many ways explains the rise of Trump, that it was, you know, Trump was sort of a mechanism for holding on to some of that influence and for implementing policy goals, including but not limited to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And in Trump, you know, evangelicals found a, you know, a very effective instrument for their objectives.
And even with the decline in the white evangelical church, how would you compare his support today in this race with 2016?
From what we can see, it doesn't look that different. We saw again in 2020 that almost as many, or depending on which exit poll you look at, about the same share of white evangelicals voted for Trump as had in 2016, around 8 in 10. In the early primaries, the primaries that led up to the present, where Trump is now the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party, exit polls suggested that white evangelicals played a big role in supporting him and making him, you know, once again the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. So the support doesn't seem to have waned, despite many predictions that it would. Part of that, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that quite simply, Trump did deliver on evangelical policy goals. And so evangelicals are, by and large, pretty happy with him. And two, there's another phenomenon, which is that it appears that as people become more, people who are friendly to Trump are more likely to identify as evangelical than they might have otherwise. There's some Pew data that suggests that some people, at least some small number of people, have newly identified as such because of their support for Trump. And, you know, sociologists, researchers I talk to think that what's happening is that people who don't identify with that movement are not using the evangelical label in the same way that they once would have. And as I described in my book, there are lots of reasons why people might move away from that label, but this seems to be a big one. So increasingly, if you use the label evangelical, it almost kind of indicates support for Trump. I mean, not for everyone, but in many cases.
Well, you know, Sarah, I'd like to thank you for being so open, you know, about your life and about what you do and continue to do. And before we wrap up, you know, as flipping through your book, you know, you flip fast and go to the back and come back to the front. But I adore what you wrote in the opening. You just said that this book is to my sons for helping me to see that parents, while imperfect, are doing the best they know how. So how does your family, have they embraced this book? What do they think?
Well, for me and for a lot of people who move away from their evangelical background, it can be very complicated with family. There can be a lot of tension there and some pain. So it hasn't always been easy. I have done the best I can to be fair and accurate. I've shared some things that were painful from my life, but also, you know, I shared those because I thought they were important. I tried to think about what were the moments for me that sort of prompted me to rethink what I believed and who I wanted to be and how I wanted to raise my own children. And so I dedicated the book in that way because I do, while I describe those realities, I do understand, especially as a parent now, that especially when you're talking about rank and file evangelicals, people are just doing their best, right? And I think they're trying to, my parents and many others were trying to raise their kids in a way that would produce happy, stable, faithful Christian adults. And, you know, they used the tools that were provided to them at the time by the evangelical movement.
Well, I can understand that. And many of us were raised totally different. So we're trying to understand that. But thank you so much for spending time with us. Sarah McCammon is a national political correspondent for NPR and co-host of the NPR Politics podcast and author of the new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Thank you, Sarah, so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for the great conversation.
This is Due South on listener-supported WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri.
And I'm Leonita Inge.
Earlier this hour, you heard from Sarah McCammon, NPR political correspondent, about her book, The Ex-Evangelicals. McCammon has covered President Donald Trump, his campaigns, as well as the intersection of religion and politics for NPR. Her book follows her own childhood and McCammon's path to leaving the white evangelical church, which she also documents as a rising phenomenon.
Now we're going to talk about the evangelical influence on politics in North Carolina and the South. Jeff Tabiri spoke with Chris Cooper, a political science and public affairs professor at Western Carolina University, and Lily Knepp, senior regional reporter at Blue Ridge Public Radio.
Okay, big and broad to start, using a historical long view, please. Chris, fill in the remainder of this sentence. Influence of white evangelicals in modern-day politics is?
Pretty consistent since about the late 1970s. How's that for a wonky statement? But really, I mean, I think the late 1970s was when we started seeing the rise of evangelicals, the rise of the Christian right. I think the marriage of Ronald Reagan with evangelicals moving into the 1980s, and then folks like Ralph Reed that continued that going forward through the Bush administrations. And it's sort of kept going since then. So I think this is a story, of course, it begins earlier than that, but I think really kind of reached its zenith in the 70s. Reagan was the next big high water mark and then kind of continued on until today.
Okay. So this the narrative of it's peaking or it's at its height, you don't necessarily buy that. From your perspective, as I'm hearing you and mirroring it back to you briefly, it's been this way for four or five decades.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if you look at the numbers of evangelicals, it's not really on the rise. If you look at voting behavior of evangelicals, it hasn't really changed. Again, I think the key really was Reagan. I mean, somebody who was not particularly religious, somebody who evangelicals thought that they saw a friend in, certainly not a foe, not somebody who mirrored their lifestyle choices, but somebody who did very much mirror the kind of America that they wanted to see.
How have things changed, if at all, in the wake of two Trump candidacies, now a third Trump candidacy, 2016, 2020, 2024, in Western North Carolina, as it pertains to white evangelicals in politics? And I don't mean to beat the same drum here. And if you're like, Jeff, you're not paying attention, there aren't changes, then please just say that and we'll move on. But I am curious, have you noticed any wrinkles or any differences here in the last 8 years?
You know, I think the West is a little bit later on a few things, right? We're maybe a couple months after everybody on fashion, and I think we're a little bit later on partisan realignment as well, right? So we were a Democratic region much longer than most of the rest of the state was. So it's a little bit of a lag, and I think maybe what's changed is that lag has finally come out here out West, right? And so you had counties in the far western part of the state that were Democratic. You could be very conservative and a Democrat, and that was not anathema until fairly recently in American politics, in Western North Carolina politics, I should say. And so I think the partisan implications of that marriage have come a little bit later here. I think that's probably the change in the West.
Lily, build on that or go in a different direction if you would. As a reporter who has followed the role, the influence of religion in Western North Carolina, what have you observed that is maybe new here in the last couple of election cycles?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this, so much of this conversation revolves around national politics and looking at and wondering, you know, who's going to support President Trump. And here in Western North Carolina, you know, far Western North Carolina in particular, they really supported President Trump in the previous elections. We're talking 60-70% in many of the counties. And I think that was surprising to some folks, you know, talking about evangelicalism and morality. I think there was an uncertainty in those first few elections, like if those folks were going to support Trump. And we've seen that they have. And, you know, at recent political events that I've been at, you know, that hasn't wavered. You know, they're selling T-shirts with his mugshot on them. A consistent support for Trump. And I think that's what's kind of interesting when you talk about evangelicalism in terms of the Republican Party.
I'm going to ask about a Pew Research Center piece that came out a few weeks ago in a moment. But I want to hang on something you just note there, Lily, and try to go a little bit deeper. Because I've been to a handful of Trump rallies across the last eight years, or I suppose 9 years. Now, I think the first Trump rally I went to in Raleigh at the Dorton Arena was in 2015, late 2015. And to me, there's this intersection, this crossover or not crossover between religion and identity, right? Like the image that you just gave, which I think is a great one, is T-shirts being sold with pictures of Donald Trump's mugshot. Right. This doesn't like fall into the pews for me. Like this isn't chapter and verse. This isn't scripture. This bigger conversation about white evangelicalism and politics, is this more about religious or is this more about identity and kind of hitting particular cultural notes, if you will? Either of you can take that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the line between identity and culture is so blurry. Like I mean, I've had so many conversations about that as a journalist, but also as a person, you know, in the workplace. And how you were raised versus what you end up believing really, I think, cements kind of a lot of your beliefs. But some people, you know, go completely opposite of that. And they were raised one way and that puts them into a totally different category. And I think what is really interesting at some of the events that I've seen is, you know, we had Congressman Chuck Edwards, that debate, that's where I saw that T-shirt. And, you know, that debate in Brasstown, all the way out in Cherokee County, North Carolina, was against Christian Reagan. And many of the folks in that crowd were Christian Reagan fans because they thought that Congressman Chuck Edwards isn't far enough to the right. And so it really is interesting as you have these discussions as far as culture and identity goes.
And Chris, coming to you in just a moment, but Lily, I want to underscore this and make sure I've got it right. Chuck Edwards was not wearing the T-shirt with Donald Trump's mugshot, just
no,
to be
no,
clear,
we should
correct?
Clarify. He was not wearing the T-shirt.
Okay. Chris, talk to me a little bit about this religious identity versus this, you know, cultural acceptance of a candidate. Like, how much of this is religion and how much of this is Donald Trump is speaking their language?
I think Donald Trump's speaking their language, and I think we need to remember, at least in terms of the general election, this is a choice between two candidates, right? This is not Donald Trump versus, you know, somebody else that they might prefer personally, but not ideologically. And so even if white evangelicals, let's be honest, that's who most of these studies were talking about. And in the West, that's particularly who we're talking about. Even if they might not like Trump's actions, they still think he's the one who's likely to appoint a pro-life Supreme Court justice, for example, who's more likely to support their policies. And so I think ultimately it is about so much of what we talk about in American politics. It's team, right? It's the intersection of culture, identity, and politics, and religion is absolutely part of that. And I think that's what this Pew study is so interesting, because it shows that some of these things are true whether you go to church or not, right? It's about whether you identify as an evangelical. So if I say I'm an evangelical, I've been to church in the last few months, my behavior really isn't that much different than if I say I'm an evangelical and I went to church three times last week.
That's Chris Cooper on the line, political science and public affairs professor at Western Carolina University. So too is Lily Knepp, senior regional reporter at Blue Ridge Public Radio. And Chris used the T word a moment ago. He said team. I'll just add tribalism or tribes in there, because that is another, I think, T word that is ripe in this moment in American politics. Let's talk a little bit more about this Pew Research Center piece that came out a few weeks ago. Its findings had several of them. The piece was titled Five Facts About Religion and Americans' View of Trump. I want to just hit you with the first, and then we're going to unpack it a little bit. Quote, among religious groups, white evangelical Protestants continue to have the most positive opinion of Trump. Overall, two-thirds of white evangelical Protestants say they have a favorable view of the former president, including 30% who have a very favorable opinion of him. However, in every other U.S. religious group large enough to be analyzed by this survey, large majorities have unfavorable opinions of Trump. So why do white evangelicals stand out here by such a large mathematical margin?
Sure. I mean, I think part of it is when they say these other religious groups, they include agnostics in there, right? A group that I think many of us would say is not particularly religious, right? So this is sort of everything else in the other bucket. But I think it's kind of what Lily pointed to in terms of culture, right? It's this almost perfect marriage of religion, culture, and partisanship. So part of what we're picking up here is white evangelical Christians are likely to be Republicans. And I think at this point in American political history, people are hip to the question, right? If you ask somebody, what do you think of Trump? They know what you're asking. They know why you're asking. If you call from the Pew Foundation, they know that you're going to use this to report about politics. And so I think they're trying to say, I like Trump's policies. It's not so much that they would want to hang out with the guy or they think he's even their candidate, but they like him better than the alternative because he wants to realize, from their perspective, an America that moves closer to the America that they want.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that the way that white evangelicals have been able to kind of galvanize around particular issues like abortion. Currently, I think trans rights is really kind of the new discussion topic. And I think that is, they are galvanized around that in a way that other religions potentially are not. You know, you look at the way that evangelicals, you know, want to talk about policy and politics at church. Other religions, not so much. They definitely don't have the monopoly on morality as we talk about it. But I think that it is really interesting to see how they've brought those teams together.
This overlay between the religious right, evangelism, and the current Republican Party, I guess I want you to go next level here for us, please. I want to go from the Trump candidacy and kind of the Trump permeations in this conversation to what has transpired in North Carolina because of Trump and because of these inroads he's made. And I'm going to drop two names and then just kind of let you offer your own observations here. I'm almost surprised that we've been talking for 12 minutes and none of us have yet mentioned Mark Robinson, who's running for governor. None of us have yet mentioned Michelle Morrow, who logged an upset in the Super Tuesday primary of a sitting statewide elected official. Both are Republicans, and both, to me, seem like, you know, maybe they're a product of Trump candidacy, and they're utilizing the energy from this white evangelical base we're talking about. I want you to, I don't know, unpack that a little bit more for me or tell me why I'm warm or cold, please. Lily?
You know, you talked about kind of speaking the language of these voters more than, and to go along with that policy. And I feel like what I'm surprised that we haven't brought up yet is just the high percentage of unaffiliated voters in North Carolina. You know, here in Western North Carolina and overall across the state, that is the largest block. And so there really is, you know, hard data around folks being dissatisfied with kind of the status quo and the two political parties. And so being able to speak to kind of as an outsider, as someone who's going to bring change, be different. A lot of talk about being a straight shooter, I feel like, when you talk about Mark Robinson and Donald Trump. And so I feel like that is a very unifying aspect. I think when you're talking about Michelle Morrow, that desire to have change in the state is something that I think really brings everyone together. But you do, you know, you still need to talk about politics or the religion piece of this. A lot of what Mark Robinson has said, those videos that come out, those are, a lot of those are from behind the pulpit. And so I think it really is overlaying that dissatisfaction as an unaffiliated voter and an unaffiliated religious person, you know, that those kind of strong numbers.
Chris, a thought here? No.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, Mark Robinson, you know, we talked about the marriage of culture, religion, and politics. And Mark Robinson is kind of the marriage of religion, politics, and pro wrestling, right? I mean, sort of the idea that there is an attitude, there is a style that connects in much the same way that Donald Trump does. I mean, you can't watch Mark Robinson but think that he presents so much like Donald Trump, but with this evangelical religious flair. And let's be honest, he has kind of a more authentic claim on being an evangelical than Donald Trump. I don't think, you know, Donald Trump certainly says he's a Christian. I don't think anybody confuses Donald Trump with a real evangelical Christian. I think that's exactly what Mark Robinson is. And so if you're trying to reach that community, what a perfect marriage of kind of signals and identity to send to those voters.
All right, just a couple of moments left in our conversation. Unfortunately, I feel like we could chat about this for a while. We're talking about, you know, potential change, and there's a level of disengagement, a level of dissatisfaction in politics that maybe none of us have mentioned. I think it's simmering right beneath the conversation here, and that is part of all this as well. But in our final moment or two, what are you going to be paying attention to, looking at, thinking about, as we think about the overlay of white evangelical efforts in politics here in the next few months as we head toward the general election?
You know, I think part of it's about mobilization, right? I mean, we know where these voters lean, right? We know they lean to the right. We know they lean towards the Republican candidates, towards the conservative candidates. But what motivates them to get off the couch or out of the pew and to the voting booth? I think that's really what's going to be the difference maker, what I'm interested in to watch, right? We know that Trump is a bridge too far for some people. Perhaps Mark Robinson is. That doesn't mean that they're going to go and support Josh Stein or Joe Biden, probably. But do they still show up to vote? Do they not show up to vote with Michelle Morrow? I mean, here's somebody that everybody's just learning about for the first time. I think even lots of folks who voted for her, she was higher on the ballot than her opponent, right? So there was a lot of kind of lack of awareness. There was high ballot roll-off on that particular election, meaning a lot of people who didn't actually vote for that office but voted the rest of the ticket. So to what degree do evangelicals stay motivated and mobilized to vote? It's kind of my big question.
Yeah, I think we saw pretty low turnout here in Western North Carolina during the primary and a lot of ballot roll-off, like Chris said. And so who's really going to be driving folks to the polls? Because I think that's another way that elections are won, is if everybody just stays home.
Lily Knepp is senior regional reporter at Blue Ridge Public Radio. Chris Cooper is professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University. Thanks for chatting with us here on Due South.
Enjoyed it. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is produced by Quilla. For Leonita Inge, my name is Jeff Tiberi. Remember, for more Due South, head over to DueSouthRadio.org. Download, subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you do that on-demand listening.